what we're going to be doing in the next 5 years, a sort of with and post-corona world. I can say for myself, and I think John can mirror this, that this is a very difficult time for pretty much everyone, especially for us as keynote speakers, right? John, it's like, I don't know, have you been traveling much? Probably not.
No. I'm prisoner in paradise. It's a lovely paradise to be a prisoner. But, yeah. Trapped in paradise.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, same thing here, the Golden Cage in Switzerland. But we are virtually traveling to do a lot of virtual keynotes, so that's a good start, and also, you know, really pivoting what we're doing. The way we're going to do this now is John is going to kick it off with his presentation and his thoughts on the post-corona, the new paradigms, the new world, and then I will follow with my short presentation, which is only about 10 hours. No, just kidding. I'll keep it short. And then we're going to have a debate and discussion and pick up on your questions remotely as well. So with that, John, why don't you dive in?
All right, well, let me go and see if I can get this screen sharing business happening. We do this, and we should be on.
Yes,
so, Gerd, thank you for the invitation. I took it on, and after I accepted, then I thought about what it was that I just accepted. So, Gerd asked if I would speak for 10 minutes about capitalism, climate, inequality, and collaboration, which I will do. And I'll overlay it with what I see as a very hopeful scenario, which is the increasing acknowledgement of the power of play. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So to begin, though, paradigms. I was watching James Lovelock the other day. He turned 101. And I was thinking, what a lovely example of a paradigm shift from someone who looked at the world as a mass of chemicals to seeing it as a living organism and a self-regulatory organism. So today I want to talk about paradigms. We've shifted paradigms many times. We've seen ourselves as the center of the universe, and now we're stuck somewhere out on the outskirts of it. But really, when we think about paradigms, it is our beliefs that shape our reality. We don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are, and we bring our cultural backpack to that, and we also bring our privilege and our biases. It's also beholden to all of us, really, to have choice. We all have choice, and it's our choices that define who we are, and it'll define how we get on moving forward. The world hasn't really changed in terms of paradigms. You know, we've been going shopping, we've been sleeping, we've been going to work, we've been doing things the way that we have been doing things because that's the way that they are. And if we look at institutions for the last 50, 100 years, they haven't really changed very much. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing sameness at the same time as change. And the two trends that we can see with that change is that it's coming faster and it's more complex in the way that it's arriving. So what do we do? We're faced with things that we've never been faced with before. We're being asked to make decisions about things we have no information about. We don't have data that informs anymore. So we're forced to inventing new possibilities for ourselves. And President Macron was earlier on in the year famously quoted as saying, you know, we have no choices left but to invent a future for ourselves. So this then means, well, how do we do that? You know, when you look out to the stars, there's an infinite mass out there. And in terms of our understanding, perhaps one of those bright little specks, if we're generous, you know, we really don't know very much. And their answers to our issues actually exist, I believe, in that unknown space, in that unknown territory. So how do we navigate that unknown territory? Well, as I mentioned earlier, there's a renaissance in play. Plato describe play as the leap. And in order to leap, you have to play with the ground and understand how you can use the ground to actually leverage yourself higher. And on the other side, you have to learn how to land safely. So the liftoff and the landing. And we as humans, animals, we all learn this, not through instruction, but through trying it out and play. Evolutionarily, play has enabled us to be here. It would have been bred out of us if it didn't have a role. And as Einstein said, it's actually the purest form of research available to us. This is a picture of me in March, just before lockdown, at the Taj Mahal, jumping and expressing my playfulness. Some, I think, misunderstanding has been around play, that actually play is a waste of time, or it's something you do in your free time, or it's the opposite of work. This is not true at all. The opposite of play is actually depression. And when you think about it, you know, many people right now are in fear, and fear actually kind of narrows your peripheral vision, and it also narrows your thinking process and your ability to think outside the box, or to think of something completely new, beyond the box. So I believe it's super powerful, and it's one of the tools that we can use to navigate our way forward. Sadly, I have to say around play is we're not seeing it happening enough in our schools. Kids are less and less playing, which means that their play histories are not going to be rich. And Dr. Stuart Brown did some research and showed that the play histories of psychopaths were very, very limited. So I think one of the things that we need to do is instill more free play in our kids in order for them to be the future that we need. It's difficult because creativity and play, those are things you can't measure, but because you can't measure them doesn't mean they don't have value. I'd like to try a little activity with you, please. I'm hoping you have a pen and paper or a pencil and paper with you. I'd like you to write down with your dominant hand. For most people, that would be your right hand. I'd like you to write down a question about a challenge that you're facing right now. And if you could frame that question, please, as a WH question, that's a what or a how or a why or something like that. And let me just give you a moment just to write that down. And if you don't have a piece of paper there, just write it with your finger. It's important to actually go through the physical action of writing. So just take a moment and write down a challenge, a question about a challenge you face. Now, I can't see you. I don't know how far you've got with that. So I'll give you a few more seconds to have a think about it. Now, taking the pen, I'm right-handed. What I'd like you to do, please, once you've finished writing your question, is to pass the pen into your other hand, your less dominant hand. And if you could, write an answer to your question using your other hand. And again, let's just take a moment for you to do this. Now, the purpose of this exercise really is just to shift paradigms, to go from one hemisphere of the brain to the other. You're forced by writing in your less dominant hand, you're forced to think about a sentence that's quite short because your writing is not so great. You're also using different aspects of your brain. And hopefully you've come up with an answer that maybe surprises or that you didn't know existed there. But it's just an example, a very short example of how we can quickly change paradigms and through that actually get different perspectives and different answers to issues. So capitalism, what an enormous topic. My belief is we've been kidnapped by capitalism. You know, we're now working for capitalism rather than capitalism working for us. And it's pretty evident that the current systems are no longer working for the majority of us. In New Zealand, we have some shifts happening. We have a government that is more interested in long-term social well-being than short-term profit, I believe. We've got new language coming in. So one of those new pieces of vocabulary is talk of a heart of state rather than a head of state. We also have here in New Zealand talk in Parliament of tax being love. So rather than paying tax, you're actually giving love to people in need. So these kinds of reframing of things. New Zealand signed up just before Christmas to a zero carbon legislation. And so it's on its way towards that. There's also quite a movement here for a regenerative and circular economy, and local councils are starting to come on board with that. So we are seeing change. It's certainly not all rosy, and there's a lot of discrepancy here and inequality here. I mean, health being one of them. You know, we live in I live in a country that has systems that were bought by colonizers and a monocultural system. And really now those are being challenged in terms of health outcomes for Māori and European Pākehā who have arrived. There's a 10-year gap in longevity, and that needs to be closed. And in part of that closing, it's the decolonizing of the systems. So that's a movement that I think is happening not just in New Zealand, but around the world. In the bigger view of inequality, I mean, these figures are just shocking, aren't they? You know, when you think that there's 500 million people that have moved into absolute poverty this year due to coronavirus. 500 million, you know, how do we even get our heads around that? And that the number of people dying from hunger is going to double. That's 18 million from 9 million. Now, we know what the vaccine is for hunger. The question is, you know, are we really willing to make the choices? Are we really willing to share? Are we really willing to change the situation? A situation where you have half of the world's wealth in the hands of 1% of the population. Now, when it comes to climate emissions, there's a lot of talk of individual action, and absolutely, we all have a role to play. But this doesn't let the corporates off the hook. I was amazed, you know, that 25 businesses have actually contributed to half of the global emissions. So there's enormous responsibility, and individuals probably don't have the power without collective action or government action to bring these organizations into check, because they don't seem to be self-regulating fast enough for us. So, you know, what do we face? We face a future where radical change is required if change is going to happen. If we leave it, we're actually on, you know, it's incremental or exponential, rather. It's not incremental at all. It's exponential, the curve. And, you know, it's too late to teach somebody to swim when they're drowning. So we've got this call for action. And we've got people around the world who are answering that call. Many of the solutions have already been found. There's a lovely film, 2040, that shows many of the answers that are available to us right now. So it's about collective will. It's about collective action. And it's about thinking of a new future with solutions that we don't even know about yet. No, and capitalism itself, perhaps if we're still using that word, we're not thinking hard enough about what a new paradigm could really be and really do for us. So, Gerd, that really is, in a short presentation, my view on things right now. I believe together we can have change, and I do believe that being playful and finding answers in the unknown is going to serve us well. So Thank you. I look forward to questions.
Great. Thanks very much, John. That was quite interesting. When I was reading your preparation, I was thinking that the most important thing here really is the idea of playing with possibilities, right? Because that seems like the mindset. And, you know, it's hard to say to people who are in trouble, you know, who are fighting for survival, to tell them to play, so to speak. Right?
And in fact, actually, Gerd, you can't play when you're in that fight or fright mode. So you have to, and animals, you know, play when they feel safe. So we do have to, in order to be playful, we have to create, and organizations have to create safe spaces for people to be, in order for that to happen.
Yeah, it seems like that's very much a government job also right now, which is an interesting angle. You know, in Europe, we have the governments essentially providing a basic income now to many of us. And that, I think it's also true for New Zealand. And
it is.
The U.S. is trying to go into a similar direction. But, I mean, this is creating a safe space for us to be able to adapt and to be able to figure out. And like here in Switzerland, you know, we have had great support from government. And it's, of course, in Switzerland, people trust government, like just like New Zealand, to do the right thing. So it's a little bit easier if you do that, right? I heard rumors about Italy. You know, people, Italians are saying, well, that's great. We're going to get all that money from Europe. But by the time it gets here, we have gone. You know? So they have all kinds of concerns about trusting government and creating that safe space.
Trust is huge. And when there's trust, I mean, there's enormous speed that's possible. And when there's no trust, of course, the opposite is the case.
Yeah, so great. Thanks very much for your contributions there. We're going to go back to it after I do my thing. Just in case you guys have just tuned in, of course, we're live on YouTube and LinkedIn. And there is a tool called Mentimeter. You go to menti.com, menti.com. Use the code 9928636. That 9928636 to dial to log in, and then you can ask any questions you want or any comment, but keep it short so we can see it in the word cloud later. Okay. So let me go into my presentation mode here. You know, when I think about new paradigms and what's happening, John, I think you can mute your mic. That would be good. Great. Thank you. So when I think about new paradigms, I've been looking at the last 3 months and you know, what is changing because of COVID, you know, apart from all the survival, the fear of survival that we have and all the pivoting that goes on. And I think there's four basic things I want to share with you. And we've had lots of debate about this in the preparation for this event, right? First, you know, it's really quite clear that as we're moving into this future, there is total and utter uncertainty, right? And this is creating a paradigm change, because when we have uncertainty, we're more ready to make a leap, right? To go into a different direction. So this is clearly going to make a difference for us. Also, when John, let me just mute your mic. Okay, sorry. So when we talk about this, you know, we're going into a direction where we're saying, okay, how can we understand this uncertainty, and how can we get beyond it? And I think really what we have to see is that 2020 is a total change of program. It's a change of program in terms of our priorities, in terms of what we have rediscovered, you know, solidarity, connecting to each other, the importance of people, and so on. And this is really impacting all industries, including tourism and of course, airlines and flying, because some things will just be switched off, right? Some programs will not continue, like, I believe cruise ships will not continue. That's a program that's ending, right? And then there's other programs, like my own program, you know, going off to faraway places and giving keynotes. And now this program is changing, right? It's pivoting. It's completely different. Great cartoon I saw the other day. I think this will enlighten us a little bit as to what's happening here, right? In this change of program, first wave is COVID. And that isn't over, obviously. I'll talk about that shortly. And that's followed by a recession or by economic reset, which we're currently looking at. And then the real big wave behind this is climate change. Right? I mean, think about the logic. Think about the logic. If we are willing to sacrifice because of health reasons and we stay at home or we wear a mask or, you know, we don't travel, are we going to be willing to do the same thing for climate change? I think it's the same logic, right? It has to be done. And now we must do it. And we do it for the common good. And the government is telling us what to do. So that's a huge paradigm shift that's becoming possible to do something that was considered impossible before. And it's really quite clear when we look at the world around us, we're not going back to normal. I mean, whatever normal was, you know, we're not going back to a world that's going to be unlocked and be like a year ago. We're going forward to a new normal, a with Corona normal, a with issues future. And also, I think, really important point, you know, we don't really want to go back to a future that has, to a past that has failed us. A lot of the normal of the past wasn't good. Inequality, bad healthcare systems. And we see the countries that were struggling before, now they're really struggling, right? US, UK, Brazil, South Africa. The normal has failed us. Look at these stats here, right? I mean, the anomalies in temperature that you can see here, mind-boggling how that has changed over the years. The CO2 emissions, of course, led by China and the United States, right? And climate refugees, after 4 degrees global warming, that's basically the entire Southern Hemisphere. And clearly we're going to see a lot of changes coming there. It's about the billionaires, you know, that have created this huge inequality. 2,153 billionaires hold more wealth than the poorest 4.6 billion combined. And now we're feeling it. Now we're actually understanding what that means, right? Great quote here from Mariana Mazzucato from the World Economic Forum. She says, a killer virus has exposed more major weaknesses within the capitalist economies. Now we have the opportunity to fix the system. If we don't do that, then we have no chance against the next major crisis, another pandemic, artificial intelligence, geoengineering, climate change. So this is the mindset right now. The narrative is changing. And I can feel that changing. I give many, many speeches per week now here online. I can feel that feedback coming back from people. And I think it's really important that we embrace this idea of what's coming next. I call this a great transformation. And over the last 3 months, we've worked on some graphics here internally for, you know, saying what is the great transformation? What does it mean? And we've come up with a globe here, right? And this, I think you'll appreciate this, the things that's on top, right, you know, in the past, cruise ships and a global economy and oil and gas and Bitcoin and banking. And now all of a sudden in this crisis, we are switching this entire pyramid around, right? And before you know it, new things are on the top. And if we don't get this, I think it's going to have dire consequences for your career and your thinking and your company, but also, of course, for your community, right? Now it's all about remote working. We're supposed to stay there. It's all about the stuff that is changing, right? It's about healthcare. It's about connecting. Right? It's about government. Right? Bottom line in this great transformation, I think it is a crisis. Let's make no doubt about that. And we have to first and foremost survive. But it's also opportunity to reboot how we're thinking about the world. Right? And this is how we're thinking about the world now. And it's pretty straightforward, right? COVID is egging on this chain reaction of things, right? Big tech, big media, big state, big government, big healthcare, and finally, big green. For some reason, I think that is driving the discussion about what is next with climate change. Those are gigantic opportunities. I also think that in terms of unemployment, we may be seeing more unemployment in the future. That's quite clear. But if we put the money in the right place here, we're going to see many, many new jobs here in big health and big green and, of course, big state. And technology is the driver behind all of those things. So when we look a little bit further of this with technology, I just want to give a quick warning here that I think when we're thinking about technology, we have to be very careful of too much of a good thing that can be a very bad thing. You know, it can be a present, but it can also be a bomb, right? It can be a situation where we're saying, well, you know, this could be a gift to us and we can just enjoy it, right? But at the same time, if we do too much of it, it turns into a major problem, into kind of a bomb. And I have no idea why the bomb isn't playing, but it's supposed to be a bomb. You know, this is the way it goes. Talking about a bomb, right? You see here on the left, Hiroshima, and you see on top of that, the nuclear non-proliferation treaties that were reached about, I think, 14 years later, I think 1962, actually, so quite a bit of time later, right? We had to have a bomb to react on the threat. and to do something about it and to come up with a moratorium. And I think it's going to be very much the same thing when we kind of have a healthcare bomb now. And will we see others? Clearly, climate change is of that nature. But in my view, is you know, it's quite clear. We cannot wait until we have reason and proof anymore. We barely survived it with a nuclear bomb. If we're going to survive that with climate change or with AI or genetic engineering, right, we have to be proactive. Right? And we have to think about what that means for our future before it actually happens. So it brings me to my third point, and that is many things that we thought of as unthinkable are actually possible now. We didn't think it was possible people were going to get a basic income for most of the year. We didn't think it possible to regulate everything like this. But now we do, and basically in this regard, you know, we're going to see carbon taxes. We're going to see carbon taxes for flying. We're going to see carbon taxes for meat. Right, we're going to see the things that were unthinkable, and so let's forget about what wasn't thinkable. Let's think about what we need to do. For example, in climate change, it's quite clear the for the rise of 1.5 degrees that it would need to fall 7.6% per year for the next decade. That's more than we have right now involuntarily because of COVID-19. We'd have to have more stringent restrictions that we have right now. And I think that's going to be a tall order. I mean, going back to what I said about meat, right? I mean, this chart kind of shows what's happening. You know, we're going into cultured meat and novel vegan meat replacement, all of these things. That goes for the same discussion. You know, maybe the future is vegetarian. I'm not vegetarian, but maybe I'll have to change in the future. I'm not big on meat, but so it wouldn't be that difficult for me. But this is one of the things where the story is changing, the paradigm is changing. Do we really need this? Can we make voluntary contributions to our future? So clearly in this world, you know, where we're moving into this sort of pivoting moment, I often say it's either the Green Deal, you know, what's called the Green Deal in the US and also in Europe, the European Green Deal, and of course in New Zealand, which has been wide discussion and of course realization also of this. Either the Green Deal or a done deal, right? We're not going to survive a situation where we don't pay attention to this. I mean, clearly, I think that's kind of a must-see for our future. Capitalism, John talked about this before. It's really quite clear that traditional capitalism is unfit for the future. And I'm not saying that we're going to have an alternative that we know about right now in terms of, you know, socialism practices or other economic logics, but we have to mutate capitalism, right? Sustainable capitalism, post-capitalism. I mean, if we're looking at the stats, pretty straightforward. I mean, the probability of losing a job because of COVID-19 is the highest for the people who don't make the most money, right? I mean, it's quite clear. This is the tough spot to be, and that's not much money. And everybody else who makes more money is going to be safer, right? It's this kind of inequality that's driving a huge change. John talked about this already. It's quite clear people are going to be pushed into poverty, especially in the US and Brazil, India, Russia, and so on. And this stat should really give you something to think about when you look about what's happening in America with inequality. I mean, this is why we have all the issues in the US. This is why the US is kind of a dysfunctional country now. And to wrap it up with a quote here by Al Gore, right? He says, as economists are ready to reopen, we should not go back to pre-pandemic thinking. Right? We need to think about something that is after the pandemic. What is desperately needed, he says, and what we must deliver is a sustainable form of capitalism. How do we do that? Well, we have to play. Right? We have to experiment. We have to go away from this kind of thinking. I call this ego systems. Right? Closed bubbles, and that is closed countries, closed economies, closed jobs, closed companies. It's all about switching to ecosystem, to a new way of thinking. I think John was alluding to that as well, and we'll discuss it shortly, how we can build this kind of idea of large things collaborating. Here's a great quote from the CEO of Salesforce, Mr. Benioff, Mark Benioff, talking about what is happening with capitalism.
Capitalism, as we have known it, is dead. And this obsession that we have with maximizing profits for shareholders alone has led to incredible inequality and a planetary emergency.
Well, I do hope you were able to hear this, but Mark is a pretty amazing guy. Capitalism, as we know it, is dead. And this has been echoed by so many people. It's not dead because it wasn't working. It's dead because it's not fit for the future. And whatever we're going to end up calling it, we're going to have to reinvent our economic logic. We're going to have to think about which way we want to go. We have to think about what we want. I mean, this illustration shows that different countries have different emphasis, right? From the sort of corporate capitalism of America to the social capitalism of Europe, and sometimes it's called the data capitalism, the state capitalism of China, right? So what is the right system? And of course, I live in Europe, and I quite admire what is happening lately in Europe. Despite all the troubles, we found a way forward to show solidarity for each other, and that is called the social capitalism. I think that's the winning ticket, and in many ways, New Zealand is following the same direction. And we have to think about how we can actually enlarge this and bring it forward to the world. So as we think about capitalism, much has been said in the past about different paradigm. And now in the U.S., you have a stakeholder debate versus a shareholder debate. And so I use this animation here to kind of show what's happening is that we need to think about four different streams of things at the same time, not just financial benefit. And that is people, planet, purpose, and prosperity. It's a quadruple bottom line. Sustainable development goals are talking about people, planet, profit. And I will enlarge a little bit by adding purpose, you know, by creating something that we want to live for. And I think that's kind of the paradigm for the future. How do we put that into place? Well, we're going to discuss it later and we'll solve the problem very quickly. Europe, right? Great story. I think what is happening in Europe, we have finally come around to solidarity. There's been a huge rescue package. Italy stands to get 100 billion euros, and Spain and Portugal and Greece and so on. Not very many questions asked, some to be paid back, but basically unlimited solidarity. And I think what we're seeing unfolding right now is indeed the sort of United States of Europe. And I have great hopes for that, even though I live in Switzerland, but I am from Germany originally, for that to become the default mode of collaboration, right, of playing to figure out the future. The heart of state, right? What is the heart of state of the European Commission? Well, it's mostly women, right? When you look at the lineup on top, it's a really interesting story. Right? So I think it's really, when we look at the future, also a huge shift of paradigm. You know, Merkel, the German chancellor, said for a long time, she will never give free money to Italy that doesn't have to be paid back, or the southern states, right? And now we have it. We're changing our mind, right? We need unconditional, almost, right, to a large degree, solidarity, or we have a collective demise. You know, what do you prefer? And this is the question that we must ask. Is it going to be solidarity, or is it going to be collective demise? Right? And that goes, for example, for education. If you're looking at this really scary chart from the United Nations, you know, we need to figure out how we're going to teach our kids. And it can't be an eight-year-old in Rio de Janeiro in a slum looking at an iPad for going to school. That doesn't work. Right? I mean, huge digital divide here. This is a problem that we need to solve urgently, right? Just as one of those collective issues. So let me wrap up by saying we're going into a new world, right? We're going into a world where everybody has to pivot. And there's four things in the water, right? Inequality, that's a little rubber raft on the top, you know, with more people, rich people keeping the benefits of everything and not being touched by COVID. The change of capitalism, that's the Kraken there, right? Climate change, and of course the virus itself. And those are opportunities. They are challenges, but they're also opportunities to rethink what we want. The key question about the future, after all, is this, right? What do we want? Do we want to go back to business as usual? No, I think business as usual is not working. It hasn't really worked. It worked for some. Now it's business as unusual, or it's a new way of defining business. And that is the paradigm shift I'm talking about. I think this is the great opportunity for brands, for companies, for ourselves, to make that shift. So a final word on this, as we're going into this future and thinking about what kind of world do we want, right? This is a question I ask myself. What kind of future do you want your children to have? If you don't have children, think about somebody else's children. What kind of world are we going to give to people? This is a question that we can and must ask right now, because now is kind of reset moment. It's the moment where you go to therapy the first time and you realize, wow, you know, now it's getting real. So thanks very much for your attention. We're going to go back to the debate here, the two of us. And I really appreciate your time listening to my diatribe here. So, John, any questions? Anything you want to add? You have to unmute yourself again. Okay, here we go.
You've got me muted.
Yes, I got you muted.
That's it. Can you hear me?
Back now.
So thank you, Ged. Lots of really interesting things there. I mean, the last one around education, super important. I mean, a couple of questions come to mind there is, you know, what's the purpose of school and education towards what? And I think whilst they're huge questions, mm-hmm. I think they're really important ones in terms of, you know, the future of our kids. And if we actually think, you know, maybe not just our grandkids, but, you know, seven generations forward, what does the future look like? And the seeds of that future
are here.
Yeah, I
think right now is a very difficult time for this, because clearly if you are disadvantaged, you don't have internet or fancy devices, or you're 8 years old, you're not going to learn like other 8 years old, year old did, right? And I think this is a huge challenge, not just that, but also what do you learn, you know? Do you learn what used to be good 20 years ago, or do you learn with the new paradigms?
Well, that's right. And what are some of the essential things, too? I mean, I think I believe you can teach an awful lot just with sand and rocks and sticks and so on. And some of that physical stuff, and we were talking earlier about play, actually feeling the world. I taught for a few months in China, and I was surprised in a class of 70 students, nobody had sat around a fire. And I thought, well, that's, you know, that's interesting. Nobody had, you know, watched the moon set. These natural phenomena are being forgotten, and as we lose touch with that, we lose touch with the being that we.
It's funny, you know, when this is of course a theme pretty much around the world, but you know, sometimes I say you will not find happiness in the screen or in the cloud, you know, because the happiness is between people. It's not in here, even though we are led to believe that happiness is an Instagram post or whatever it is, right? The same variation, and I think this is really important that we express this to our kid. You were talking in your preparation for this event about what's happening in New Zealand and the four parameters of the Māori, how they define life, right? Can you comment on that briefly? Because I think
in terms of healthcare, yeah. You know, it's maybe an Indigenous view in that, you know, we're spiritual beings, we're physical beings, we're mental beings. And we also have the family around. And so in the Māori model of health, those four elements are super important. Whereas in the, I suppose, Western or model of health, the spirit and the family, whilst they come and visit, you know, they're not integrated in the same way. And some of these, I think, some of these wisdoms that are Indigenous cultures have had for a long, long, long time are important for us to learn from, you know, around togetherness, around support. There's a Māori saying, you know, with my food basket and your food basket, we can feed everybody.
That's so funny. There's a lot of overlap between, I did a thing in Italy like 3 months ago, about, you know, what's happening and how to go forward. There was one famous picture from Italy where there was a basket coming down on a rope, and well, actually two baskets, and one said, if you don't have anything, take from the basket, and the other said, if you have something, put it in the basket, right?
Yeah.
And I think that this is a thought that is actually reoccurring to people, that we have to give back, right?
Well, it's interesting, actually, Ged, because, you know, the solution we already have is that actually we don't really want it, I think, which is it's about, you know, loving each other. It's about caring for each other. It's about sharing. And it's about, you know, what do I have that I can offer, and what do I need that you can bring me? And, you know, that doesn't require massive investments. That's just a change of mindset that could happen overnight without infrastructure. And the world would be a completely different place, a completely different paradigm.
Yeah, this is one thing I'm counting on from this crisis, is a change of mindset, you know, a change of mindset on priorities. And I think you can already feel that when people are saying that now it's like really getting down to crunch time, and you change your priorities. And your priorities are...
You do. Right? And you value things different, Gerd. I mean, you talked about, you know, value. And I know here, when lockdown came, for a moment, you know, money sort of disappeared. And people, again, valued relationships. They valued local food security and resilience and friendships. And I was surprised, really, to learn, and I feel slightly naive around this, but that education and healthcare, the value is not measured. They're just seen as sinkholes of cost. Mm-hmm. But when you think about a hospital or a school, I mean, they're enormous value creators, you know, putting people back into the workforce or just getting people, you know, back into life and not coming back into the hospital with, I don't know, diabetes or whatever it is. But, you know, looking after people and educating people and the value that that gives to society is huge. But at the moment, it's not quantifiable and therefore it's not measurable. And therefore I think it doesn't have value.
Yeah, it's one of those things where that shift has to happen in our minds first and then it happens somewhere else. But it's also not a lot of people find this to be sort of idealistic, right? Or whatever you want to, or ephemeral or, you know, something like that. But I think really it comes down to the future economic system. It's not about idealism. The future economic system has to include all these components and they have to be accounted for. For example, I don't think in the near future any CEO or any shareholder is going to get paid unless you tick off those four boxes, right? People, planet, purpose, prosperity. And that's how you should be getting paid. Yeah? And well, there's nothing wrong with that, right?
No, and there's talk, isn't there, around a social license, you know, social operating license, that you actually need to tick those things in order to be able to operate. I'm very hopeful. I see, as you do, this smell in the air of change. And I know individuals, you know, for many years have been working in these arenas for change and leadership for change. And people are doing, you know, the best that they can. And in a way, those lights are starting to pop on, or popcorn is starting to pop, you know, and collectively, I am hopeful, because otherwise I may as well just get the razor blade out and finish myself off, really.
Okay. The more it's sold, of course. But, you know, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, said the other day, there's been more digital transformation in the last 3 months than in the previous 3 years. And people adapting, and I think that's mostly good, but at the same time, of course, that creates other issues. But still, having said that, I think when we have a reason to change, right, then we actually do it. That's the question. Do we have a reason now? Do we have a reason to question our financial system, our economic logic? And New Zealand is a great test case for, you know, we have a reason to do this and we agree to do this and then we can do it, right?
Yeah. It's an interesting one because it's around behavior change. I mean, we, you know, most people would like to lose a little bit of weight and be a little fitter. And it's not a lack of information or knowledge. We know what to do, eat less and exercise more. But actually doing it is a whole other thing. So I think getting the messaging right around this, that's engaging and encouraging, and I think playful. You know, people don't want to be beaten over the head with a stick saying, you know, you're bad and you've done this and so on. But make it energized.
I think this is one, you know, when I speak to people around the world about this, I think one of the key issues is what drives us to make this change. And, you know, because humans are essentially, you know, we react to things and, you know, it's about pain or love. We don't really make a move without pain or love, right? And you know, going back to what I said about the nuclear bomb, which is kind of a bizarre example, really. But, you know, we had a bomb, two bombs that killed like 500,000 people and another 5 million later on. And that gave us a reason to say, strangely enough, we can't have another 5,000 bombs, right? And now we're here. And we've had COVID and we're saying, you know, I really think that COVID-19 is just a test run for climate change.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically saying we have to change what we're doing, put the money in new places so that we can be ready for a collectively good future. And that is what's happening with climate change.
Yeah, it's interesting. And at the same time, more and more money is being spent on arms, isn't it? And these treaties are falling over. I mean, what would the world look like if all of that money was put into well-being?
Yeah, and I think this is what's happening right now. I mean, if you're looking at the end of oil and gas, right, this is clearly happening. And now people have a reason to pull their money out from oil and gas because it's no longer profitable, right? But we do need to think a little bit further. You know, we can't always have an emergency before we start doing anything, right? And for example, I think a climate emergency, we may survive in some way or the other, but an emergency of artificial intelligence, you know, a super intelligence, singularity, you know, would we survive that? Kind of unlikely.
Right? Yeah.
So we really need to stop thinking, you know, and going into the reactive mode, and we have to imagine what it would look like. I mean, Bill Gates 7 years ago predicted the pandemic, and he wasn't the only one. And we could have prepared, we choose not to because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't on the table.
And it's around, I mean, I know it's a play on words, but, you know, responsibility, your ability to respond. And I think our ability to respond, and often we put the onus on other people, but this really is going to require all of us to make a stand.
Yeah. And I think what you were saying earlier about what is happening in terms of our mind shift, you know, this kind of future readiness and thinking beyond the obvious and the EQ, IQ concept, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clearly so around the world, we can see the countries that are best off are run by women, right? I mean, whether it's Jacinda or Ardern in New Zealand or in Taiwan or Finland or Germany with Merkel, or even though, of course, she's no longer young like the others, right? But that makes me think. It makes me think about what do we actually need? Somebody who has a further intelligence that is like this, not like, you know, economic intelligence or money intelligence. Like, you know, I wouldn't call that intelligence. Like Bolsonaro, interests, right, is in a very narrow definition of the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Jung, went through a depression, but he described three levels of sanity. There's the sort of insane, the normal, and the hyper-sane or hyper-sanity. And the normal really are sleeping people. And as R.D. Lang later talked about, he said, you know, the world loves normal men. And it's normal men who have gone and killed millions and millions of other normal men, and that's normal. And so this idea of hypersanity, which is a level up, and it's a sort of a woken upness of consciousness. And there are individuals, I think, around today who have that, different view on the world.
Yeah, I think that this is part of the challenge right now, because it kind of feels like we have the people who are nowhere close to this. They're still in power, you know, whether it's Hungary or Israel or the U.S. or the U.K., the people who are still with the old-fashioned man, so to speak, right?
Yes.
And then we have the new people exploding everywhere. And my view is that we're going to see a dramatic reset by the end of this year, because all the totalitarian and populist regimes are proving to be utterly useless in the crisis.
Isn't it interesting when reality really hits, you know, when the immutable laws really hit, this other stuff, this ego stuff, as you talk about it, actually, you know, becomes ineffective and actually starts to very quickly look like the emperor with no clothes.
Yeah. So, you know, my prediction is, you know, I've said I'm writing a piece on this, but I think we're going to see a new renaissance in America next year, a complete turnaround. After four really, really, really bad years, obviously, where it couldn't have been any worse, a complete turnaround. And we're going to see a global turnaround with young people and women and minorities coming into positions of power in governments and rallying for sort of a global agenda, even though right now it kind of feels like the opposite in many ways, right, because it's a little bit crunch time.
Interesting, actually, in 2040, you know, it talks about actually the impact of educating more women in the world. The impact of that on climate change is enormous, you know, just that simple thing. So I think so. And I think that brings hope and it brings a different paradigm. And we need that.
I really think, you know, regardless of all of the really bad things that are happening right now, they're happening to all of us here, loss of revenue, change of business models, anxiety, what people call the corona coaster, you know, the emotional roller coaster going up and down, impossible, you know. Despite all of that, I think we're developing a new way of how we look at the world, And that gives a positive momentum. Let's take some questions. We have menti.com. If you're still on the line there, I know there's 5,000 people here waiting to post something on Menti. But menti.com, M-E-N-T-I.com. The code is 928636, 928636. You can log in and ask questions. We do have some questions already, and we're also going to take a look at the Twitter feed and maybe even the YouTube comments, right? So stay on the line. Let's ask this question first. What do you think will be the paradigm shift in tourism? It's one of the questions here on menti.com. John, well, do you have a take on that?
Yeah, I mean, in New Zealand, it's local tourism. You know, I live on an island. It's a beautiful island, has 10,000 people, and we used to have 1 million-plus visitors a year coming here. And they'd fly in for, you know, a few days from different parts of the world and then get on a big bus and travel around. We don't have that anymore. So it's local. I think travel is going to be expensive. I agree with you. I think cruise ships are, probably a dying industry.
Well, yeah, I think that tourism, and I live in Switzerland, very much a tourism-bound country, right? Tourism will finally come to its senses and will reboot in such a way where it's sustainable, where it's practical, where it's respectful. And that will take some time. But ultimately, you know, people want to travel, people want to meet, people want to go to different cultures. People will do that. It will be a while before I will fly to San Francisco to have dinner by the bay or so. But clearly that's going to come back in some way or the other. But I think tourism right now has to really take that pivot approach, right? So that is going local, going sustainable, attracting people who can drive over, right? Attracting people who can take public transportation to come over, of course, respecting nature. I think we're going to see trends like tourist capitals like Lisbon instituting a culture tax when you arrive. I think those things will happen. As I was saying earlier, now the carbon tax kind of idea. So when you fly to Lisbon, you're going to pay 5 euros into a local fund that keeps the local community alive.
I think it's exciting, Gerd, because it gives us an opportunity to reflect, doesn't it, right now, and go, well, you know, what might it look like? Is it serving us in the way it is? I mean, for us as an island, these big double-decker buses that we as a community can't get on, although they go past every 30 minutes. You know, it's not really working. So what does work? And I agree with you, you know, it is around sustainability. It has to be, and value, you know, value for the community, value for the participants, and really honoring that value, I suppose. And I think that's what we will see with travel, because it's going to be more expensive. And so just going to jump on a plane and go for a weekend somewhere.
I think the kind of exploitation of travel that we've done in the past, including myself, you know, we hop to Malaga for the weekend because it's cheaper than staying in Manchester or Zurich, right? And that sort of nonsense and the cruise trips, which in my view, utter nonsense to begin with. But hey, you know, let's be tolerant and say people want to do this, but let's think about the nonsense that we don't need anymore, you know, and let's pay what it actually costs, right? I mean, if we were to pay the externalities of tourism, it would be more expensive, and maybe we would choose a different vacation to be less expensive, so that, you know, we have to pay what it actually costs. And this is very true for New Zealand and Waiheke, of course. And this is not a black or white solution, but it's something that is a new paradigm.
And I don't think solutions are geared. I mean, I think this is maybe, you know, fake perception for many is that, you know, it's either this or it's that. It generally isn't, is it? There's multiple answers, lots of shades of gray. Just a little factoid. I don't know if you know, only 10% of the planet has flown.
Really?
And again, you know, that begs the question, well, if you kept going the way that we were, would that then become, you know, half the planet? And what's the impact of that? So we've kind of drawn the line at 10% of the planet flying, and that's an opportunity to reassess.
Yeah, I think that for me, that's very important. Like, this should not be anti-business or anti-flying or anti-tourism or anti-anything, right? It's subject to those four parameters: people, planet, purpose, prosperity, right? And every time you look at a solution as to what you're going to do locally, it has to cover those four points, right? Yeah. And I think if we were to do that, we could come up with a sustainable tourism that would also make good money, but taking out the exploitive part, right? Let's go to the other question, that second one here. any solutions and getting the 1% to contribute to the world, right? Especially in innovation to tackle issues raised. Perhaps the tool is big state, right? That's one of the questions, right? How do we get the 1% to contribute to the world?
I mean, I suppose, you know, in reality, a number of that 1% do. You know, Elon Musk would be an example of someone who has great wealth and uses it for innovation. Now, it's off his own agenda, but has created things that maybe wouldn't have happened had that not that wealth not been there. So there are people who contribute, and there are people who you know, Rockefellers and whatever, who actually, you know, make a contribution. So I don't think we can sort of just say every, you know, all of that 1% are baddies or whatever. I think that there's a point where enough is enough. I'm not sure Jeff Bezos needs, you know, any more billions really. And I think it starts to become quite undemocratic when you have an individual holding so much wealth, because there is power attached to that wealth, and it comes, you know, without, I suppose, any kind of conditions. And in terms of, you know, people, planet, purpose, it's very much an individual's decision. You know, maybe how would it be if, you know, you get to keep your first billion, but anything else beyond that actually goes back into a system.
I'm sorry, I don't have that problem, but maybe I have a first billion Italian lira or Indonesian rupee. I can have both. But I think, you know, here, I think the real difficulty is, of course, there are many people from the 1% who are making big contributions and making a huge difference, like Bill Gates and many others, right? But generally speaking, I think in a system where we have strict capitalism, there's no solution to this, because the state, the government wouldn't mingle in such a way to essentially cut down on the liberties of rich people, right? So the solution, as always, is a balance and a compromise and incentive, right? I mean, let's face it, nobody pays taxes voluntarily, right? I mean, maybe Kiwis do, I don't know. But generally speaking, it kind of feels like we need incentives and we need rules to create sensible ways of redistribution of the money. And in many ways, you can say that corporate capitalism as practiced in America is not the solution for that, right? Because it's epidemic dysfunctionally,
yeah? And big tech does very well in not paying tax, doesn't it? It finds all sorts of ways to not do that and make it.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at what's happening with the stakeholder and shareholder debate, that's the same debate. You know, the money is there; we just need to distribute it better. And I think this is something that is a question of policy. And again, this is a real threat to traditional market-free capitalism, you know, Adam Smith, Invisible Hand, and so on, you know, which clearly has worked for a while but is no longer working, right? Mm. So if we were to take it to the next step and say, how do we create a sustainable capitalism? Well, this is the key question. Where do we take the money? Who's going to be distributing it? And all of those things. And I think we're getting there very quickly here, right? Because clearly, if we don't put money into healthcare, we are in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm. And education.
Yeah. So that leads to the next question. So is the future of our children at peril because people in influential positions do not have children? That's a good one. The digital apartheid, will we ever be able to bridge the digital apartheid? So the future of our children at peril.
What does peril mean? I mean, does that mean that they're all going to die? I don't think they're all going to die. I mean, I have great faith in humanity. I think people will find ways. The question is, you know, if it's left just left, then what it looks like, we're not really going to have a say in. It's going to be whatever shakes out, and that might be, you know, it might be a future that much of the, you know, I don't know, some of the movies and things, the dystopian futures look like. And you know, we don't want that. Or I don't want that, maybe others do. So are they in peril? I think that they've got a harder task if we just leave them to their own devices. And I didn't understand the question around the giving birth? What was the?
People in influential positions don't have children, which I'm not sure that's correct, but
there is a decline. I mean, talking to my kids, you know, it's really interesting the number that don't want to have kids. So I think we're, you know, population is going to be declining. It is already, but you know, that trend is going to continue.
Well, I think generally speaking, if you ask me the question if the future is in peril, I would say it could very well be totally in peril. You know, it could be heaven or it could be hell. I mean, and basically we're at several junctions, right? My optimism comes from saying, you know, we are inventing science and technology that can solve almost all practical problems like energy, water, and food. But technology will not solve our social problem or cultural issues or political issues or policy issues and our human issues. That's up to us. You know? Technology doesn't care and doesn't know how to do that. So if you ask me if our kids are in peril, I would say, well, they could live in heaven if we were to do it right, or they could live in hell if we miss all the intersections.
Right? It's interesting you talk about that. It reminds me of the story I was told many years ago of heaven and hell. And in hell, people have very, very long arms, so long that they can't actually get the food into their mouth. But there are tables of beautiful food. And heaven is exactly the same, all these tables dripping with beautiful food. The difference is that in heaven, people can't feed themselves, but they feed each other. And in hell, nobody feeds each other. And I think that's in a way the situation that we've got now is, you know, most of the solutions are already with us. They might not be, you know, equally distributed, but they're, many of those are available. And so it is about now mind shift.
Yeah, and I think we have a comment on this as well from the comment section here. It says, you're very optimistic. Looking at the political trends, you see more nationalism and protectionism, a trade war, and the United States of Europe is utopia. It is even hard to agree on shared democratic values. Well, I tend to not agree. You know, I think this is a little bit like a couple of years ago before the COVID crisis. We looked at the world and the media was telling us that everything is going to hell, right? Things are getting worse and worse and worse. But if you're looking at Max Römer's and stats and all of the stats of the data world and so on, Hans Rosling and so on, you can clearly see that's actually, objectively speaking, the stats have gotten better, right? Less poverty, less childbirth death, more education, more women at work, and the story goes on, right? So that is very hard to see right now because it kind of feels like everything is falling apart in so many ways, right? And yes, we have protectionism. We have clashes of culture. We have nationalists and so on. But one thing I'm seeing clearly right now is that people are realizing if their leaders are useless, it's really becoming apparent now. And people are fed up with useless leaders. And whether you're populist or not, and I also would reject, by the way, the idea that non-democratic countries are faring better. They are not. Right? If you look at the statistics and the facts, the countries that have most inequality are the ones who are doing the worst in the crisis. Right? There's a direct relationship between inequality and the number of infections and subsequently death. Right? U.S., UK, Brazil, South Africa, story goes on. So I am hopeful that people will vote with that in mind. And of course, you know, I think that technology-wise, we hold the key to the future. We have all the tools we need. You know, science fiction is science fact now, right? So that's why I'm hopeful. We just have to agree, and to agree, we need to discuss and we need to play.
That play space is a lovely space because, you know, you can't be in fear and opportunity. They don't coexist. But when you're in play, you're in that opportunity space. And play can be music, play can be sport, play can be all sorts of different variations of it. But and within play, in real play, there's no room for dominance. There's no room for sadism. You know, those don't have a place in play. Play is around helping each other really get stronger through collaboration and co-creation. And maybe it's idealism, and maybe I'm too hopeful. But I believe in humanity, and I believe that we as humans have that capacity to step up. and to step
up. I think, I get this question a lot about, why am I such an optimist? And I always say that all humanists are kind of idealists, of course, in some way. But also it comes down to the very simple questions. Do you believe that humans are evil or good? And apart from all the religious connotations, are humans basically good or are they usually evil? Right? And I would say, I think it's been proven in history that we're essentially good, parentheses, right? But we can be led to evil things, but it's not our nature to do the wrong things, I don't think, And in that regard, there was also a great saying, I think it was Winston Churchill who once said that America can always be trusted to do the right thing after they have exhausted all other possibilities. Right? And I think that's so true to our reality. And I think that is really something where we have to have that mindset about doing the right thing without exhausting all the bad things.
And at times to question things, just because something's legal doesn't mean it's right. I mean, slavery would be an extreme example of that. And I'm sure at the time that, people knew it wasn't right. So I think we do part of paradigm shifting is challenging assumptions and challenging the status quo.
There's a related question to this. It's about the developing countries, which I think we should take. How do we help developing nations to skip the consumerist stage in their development? People talk about the environmental impact of cattle farming and so on, but carbon impact of manufacturing is much worse. So how do we get developing countries to come to the table and not do what we did? That's a question I get a lot too. I think that answer is quite difficult. Do you have a take on this?
No, I mean, I think it's fair enough. If I've got refrigeration that others wanted as well, and why should I say, well, you can't have it? So again, I think technology has a play here in that we don't just roll out crap, that it's actually, we are looking for things that in that growth that are for people and planet. Is it good for the planet? Is it good for the people? Is it good for the community? It's a difficult one. It really is a difficult one.
I think the answer to me in a nutshell is we have to pay them.
Right? Yeah.
And we have to give them things that we have to make their situation better, right? So if we get water desalination machines and they're much cheaper than what we have today, and then we use them in New York and wherever, how about giving the machines and or leasing them for very, very cheap to African countries, right? And if we get the Internet of Things in our city and it's helping us to reduce the cost and CO2 output and so on, do we just license it to Lagos, Nigeria, because, we can get a high fee, or do we do it under some sort of collective license, right? And those are all questions I think that come to mind. And clearly, the only reason that we're going to get countries to pull together and to agree on this is to say that our collective future is in question.
Right? You take refugees, for instance, and the number has doubled in the last 10 years. And just think about the impact that the Syrian refugees had on Britain, really, and probably, pulling out of Brexit was in part influenced from the refugee crisis. That's only going to increase if desertification keeps going and all these other things happen. So yes, I think there's a real imperative around actually, it's about a generosity culture, but it's also about in my own best interest, because if that tide of refugees gets worse, it's going to impact everybody.
Well, if there's one thing that's
sitting comfortably.
Yeah, I mean, the COVID crisis has clearly shown that if we don't collaborate on a global level, we're toast. Right. I mean, this goes for research, it goes for practical things, it goes for restrictions, it goes for travel orders and so on and so on. I mean, it basically the only solution to larger issues like healthcare, like technology, like geoengineering and so on is a global collaboration, just like nuclear weapons. And I think this is what speaks to me against, we may have less globalization in terms of trade or supply chain and those kind of things in the next few years as a reaction, right? But we're going to have more globalization on the larger stories and the really the existential stories. Let's take one more question, and then I think we have to wrap up. Huh? So there's one question here. But what do you think will be the paradigm shift in food and beverage? Will restaurants still be relevant? How do you see the real estate around food and beverage? Will it be similar to your earlier view that travel will become more expensive? Can the same be said of food and beverage? Yeah, that's a good question. I think to me, that's the same answer. We're going to see new values emerge there. And, you know, restaurants are on a pretty good path right now. For example, in many cities around the world, the city has allowed the restaurants to go out, push further out into the street for safe dining. And that is, you know, basically the city is saying better to have the restaurant than to have a street. And that's happening around the world. And I think we're also seeing more sensible way of production and more desire to source locally. And that's been impacted by this. But clearly, you know, this sort of, let's say, I mean, the restaurant business has never been easy, right? But now we're being forced to create more value with less. And that's going to be a positive thing, I believe. Also a profitable thing, right? Once we figure out what the exact angle is. And we may have surpassed the peak of the sort of cheap way of making money, you know, like we do with airlines. I'm convinced with airlines, we've reached a peak of people splurging in travel and just jolly flying all over the world, like myself years ago, right, whenever that was. And now we've reached the peak and people are going to be more sensible. That creates more value. It will create more value. I'm certain of that.
Yeah. I think that value in part is going to be around experience. And I think, you know, we see it already with restaurants, but actually it's, you know, it's not just the food, it's the whole experience. And I think that that's going to shift. And people are going to really choreograph quite interesting new experiences for people who come, you know, for food. And yeah, I agree. I think it will be, you know, sourced locally more. I certainly think there's a future of food because it's a social institution.
Well, I mean, if it's going to be more expensive, I think anything that is going to take into consideration the whole food chain and the externalities that we need to cover, anything that does that will be more expensive. But what if the new expensive was the new normal? Right? Mm. And you would expect that this is what it is because of the costs associated with doing this, right? And then, like, you know, for example, if we would actually pay the cost of driving a car, right, it would be vastly more expensive. And you know, the answer can't always be more taxes and stuff. But eventually you would become realistic and say, you know, what do I really need to drive? I can just take the electric bubble, you know, that takes me around town, and so on and so on, even though, of course, it also costs energy. But clearly, I think that is the mindset that we have to have. It's going to be more expensive, which would create more pressure on people with lower income. We have to compensate for this. Everything points towards this. If we want a collective solution and collective happiness, parentheses, whatever that is, right, there's going to be sacrifices that we make and there's going to be gains that we get, right?
Yeah, that's right. And some of those may well, you know, come at a cost and experience of pain, maybe not physical pain, but in terms of not being able to do the things that you've been used to doing.
Yeah. So let's wrap up and let's have a short summary, John, from your end. I'll do the same, and then we'll wrap up with telling people where they can find out more about us.
Well, thank you again. It's been a fascinating hour. We've traversed lots of different topics. I mean, my sense is that actually it comes down to our humanness, I mean, in terms of our conversations, and it's also about our choices. And whilst the universe may not care what I choose, that is something, you know, my choices and my actions are things that I control. And if we collectively control those, then we define the future. I think purpose is super important. I think as a species, you know, we've got the medal for survival, and where we're not so great about is, well, what's next? You know, who and what do we want to be? And so getting clear on that collective purpose for us as a community of humans is super important. And then out of that comes values, and those then, you know, help to inform the decisions that we make. Over to you.
Yeah, I want to go back to what I said at the end of my short presentation. I think the future is better than we think. And then I put a giant asterisk, right, depending on the choices that we make. Because the future isn't fixed. You know, the future, it doesn't just fall down on us. And the future isn't done in Silicon Valley. And it isn't done in China. It's done by every single action or inaction that we take, right? And I think if we want to create a positive future, then we have to create the narrative. We have to get people aboard. We have to create a momentum as to what exactly that is, the kind of future we want. When you think about all the big changes in society and some of the trigger points like Martin Luther King or the Dalai Lama or Gandhi or, you know, those were trigger points. It wasn't just the person, right? It was like all of a sudden this is important. And I think we're now at this trigger point where we're saying, you know, what is important? Other people, our environment, a sensible system, right? A system of equality. And this is starting to percolate. So this is my hope that we can get this theory out there. The World Economic Forum calls this the Great Reset, right? Which is also a good story. I call this a great transformation, and I think we've only seen the very beginning. So let me wrap up. I think the important advice for me would be 4 points, as I've been talking to people a lot about this. First, survival, right? Make sure you survive. Make sure you're organized. Make sure you save things up. Make sure you can sustain yourselves the next year or two. Collaborate and play, right? Mm. Experiment, right? Yeah. The third one, to adapt and to pivot. If it isn't working what you used to do before, figure out a way to pivot. Again, that goes with playing, right?
It does. And you may not get it right first, but you know you keep iterating until it works.
Yeah, and the last point is, of course, transform. We have to transform now. Mm. We have to transform our thinking. We have to transform our kids. You know, we have to create that momentum towards a different world, not going back to the pre-pandemic situation, which is impossible now anyway. Okay. So let's wrap up. And John, would you tell people where they can find out a bit more about you? And I'll do the same.
Yep. So, if you go to www.johniles.com is probably the easiest place to begin. So that's www.johniles.com.
Great. And we're going to put up an elaborate post with all the video and audio and even the graphs and stuff on my website. That's futurevisgerd.com, futurevisgerd.com. And, of course, I would be vastly amiss if I wouldn't make a pitch for my book, Technology versus Humanity, which you may have already seen. It's techversushuman.com. You could buy it, of course, on all these the usual ecosystems like Amazon. And otherwise, of course, I'm on Twitter. My website, GERDtube.com, is my YouTube channel. And also on the final note, we're launching a new TV show called Where Are We Going? And John will hopefully be part of that.
And
as well.
if you need help being playful, let me know.
That's right. Yes, of course, you know, we are available to inspire you virtually. And, you know, if you happen to be in Waiheke, New Zealand, you can be literally inspired. So thanks very much for tuning in. And I really appreciate everybody coming in. And thanks for your patience with our elaboration. Thanks, John, for being there.
Thank you for inviting me, Gerd. It's been a pleasure.
See you down the road.
All right. See you.
Bye.